Track one.
It was one of those seasons when the fish came late. I worked my boat and crew hard, running far northwards each day, coming back into Grand Harbour long after dark each night. But it was November the 6th when we picked up the first of the big ones, riding down on the wine-purple swells of the Mozambique current. By this time I was desperate for a fish. My charter was a party of one, an advertising wheel from New York named Chuck McGeorge. One of my regulars who made the annual 6,000-mile pilgrimage to St. Mary's Island for the big marlin. He was a short, wiry little man, bald as an ostrich egg and grey at the temples, with a wizened brown monkey face, but the good, hard legs that are necessary to take on the big fish. When at last we saw the fish, he was riding high in the water, showing the full length of his fin, longer than a man's arm, and with the scimitar curve that distinguishes it from shark or porpoise. Angelo spotted him at the instant that I did, and he hung out on the foredeck stay and yelled with excitement, his gypsy curls dangling on his dark cheeks and his teeth flashing in the brilliant tropical sunlight. The fish crested and wallowed, the water opening above him, so that he looked like a forest log, black, heavy, and massive, his tail fin echoing the graceful curve of the dorsal before he slid down into the next trough and the water closed over his broad, glistening back. I turned and glared down into the cockpit. Chubby was already helping Chuck into the big fighting chair, clinching the heavy harness and gloving him up. But he looked up and caught my eye. Chubby scowled heavily and spat over the side, in complete contrast to the excitement that gripped the rest of us. Chubby is a huge man, as tall as I am, but a lot heavier in the stomach and gut. He is also one of the most staunch and consistent pessimists in the business. "Shy fish," grunted Chubby, and spat again. I grinned at him. "Don't mind him, Chuck," I called. "Old Harry is going to get you into that fish." "I've got $1,000 that says you don't," Chuck shouted back, his face screwed up against the dazzle of the sun-flecked sea, but his eyes twinkled with excitement. "You're on." I accepted a bet I couldn't afford and turned my attention to the fish. Chubby was right, of course. After me, he is the best billfish man in the entire world. The fish was big, and shy, and scary. 5 times I had the baits to him, working him with all the skill and cunning I could muster. Each time he turned away and sundered as I brought Wave Dancer in on a converging cross to cross his beak. "Chubby, there's fresh dolphin bait in the icebox. Haul in the teasers and we'll run him with a single bait," I shouted despairingly. I put the dolphin to him. I'd rigged the bait myself, and it swam with a fine, natural action in the water. I recognized the instant in which the marlin accepted the bait. He seemed to hunch his great shoulders, and I caught the flash of his belly, like a mirror below the surface as he turned.
"Follow!" screamed Angelo. "He follows!"
I set Chuck into the fish at a little after 10 o'clock in the morning, and I fought him close. Superfluous line in the water would place additional strain on the man at the rod. My job required infinitely more skill than gritting the teeth and hanging on to the heavy fiberglass rod. I kept Wave Dancer running hard on the fish through the first frenzied charges and frantic, flashing leaps until Chuck could settle down in the fighting chair and lean on the marlin, using those fine fighting legs of his. A few minutes after noon, Chuck had the fish beaten. He was on the surface in the first of the wide circles which Chuck would narrow with each turn until we had him at the gaff. "Hey, Harry," Angelo called suddenly, breaking my concentration. "We got a visitor, man."
"What is it, Angelo?"
"Big Johnny, coming up current," he pointed. "Fish is bleeding. He smelt it." I looked and saw the shark coming, the blunt fin moving up steadily, drawn by the struggle and the smell of blood. He was a big hammerhead, and I called to Angelo. "Bridge, Angelo!" And I gave him the wheel. "Harry, you let that bastard chew my fish and you can kiss your $1,000 goodbye." Chuck grunted sweatily at me from the fighting chair, and I dived into the main cabin. Dropping to my knees, I knocked open the toggles that held down the engine hatch, and I slid it open. Lying on my belly, I reached up under the decking and grasped the stock of the FN carbine, hanging in its special concealed slings of inner tubing. As I came out onto the deck, I checked the loading of the rifle and pushed the selector on to automatic fire. "Angelo, lay me alongside that old Johnny." Hanging over the rail in Wave Dancer's bows, I looked down onto the shark as Angelo ran over him. He was a hammerhead, all right, a big one, 12 feet from tip to tail, coppery bronze through the clear water. I aimed carefully between the monstrous eye stalks, which flattened and deformed the shark's head, and I fired a short burst. The FN roared. The empty brass cases spewed from the weapon, and the water erupted in quick, stabbing splashes. The shark shuddered convulsively as the bullet smashed into his head, shattering the gristly bone and bursting his tiny brain. He rolled over and began to sink. "Thanks, Harry," Chuck gasped, sweating and red-faced in the chair. "All part of the service," I grinned at him and went to take the wheel from Angelo. At 10 minutes to 1, Chuck brought the marlin up to the gaff, punishing him until the great fish came over on his side, the sickle tail beating feebly and the long beak opening and shutting spasmodically. The glazed single eye was as big as a ripe apple, and the long body pulsed and shone with 1,000 flowing shades of silver and gold and royal purple. "Cleanly now, chubby," I shouted, as I got a gloved hand on the steel trace and drew the fish gently towards where Chubby waited with a stainless steel hook at the gaff ready. Chubby withered me with a glance that told me clearly that he'd been in putting steel into billfish when I was still a gutter kid in a London slum. "Wait for the roll," I cautioned him again, just to plague him a little, and Chubby's lip curled at the unsolicited advice. The swell rolled the fish up to us, opening the wide chest that glowed silver between the spread wings of the pectoral fins. "Now," I said, and Chubby sank the steel in deep. In a burst of bright crimson heart blood, the fish went into its death frenzy, beating the surface to flashing white and drenching us all under 50 gallons of thrown seawater. I hung the fish on Admiralty Wharf from the derrick of the crane. Benjamin, the harbour master, signed a certificate for a total weight of 817 pounds. Although the vivid fluorescent colours had faded in death to flat, sooty black, yet it was impressive for its sheer bulk. 14 feet 6 inches from the point of its bill to the tip of its flaring swallow tail. "Mr. Harry done hung a Moses on Admiralty." The word was carried through the streets by running, barefooted urchins, and the islanders joyously snatched at the excuse to cease work and crowd the wharf in fiesta array. The word travelled as far as Old Government House on the bluff, and the presidential Land Rover came buzzing down the twisting road with the gay little flag fluttering on its bonnet. It butted its way through the crowd and deposited the great man on the wharf. Before Independence, Godfrey Biddle had been St. Mary's only solicitor, island-born and London-trained. "Mr. Harry, what a magnificent specimen," he cried delightedly. A fish like this would give impetus to St. Mary's budding tourist trade, and he came to clasp my hand. As state presidents go in this part of the world, he was top of the class. "Thank you, Mr. President, sir." Even with the black Homburg on his head, he reached my armpit. He was a symphony in black. Black wool suit and patent leather shoes, skin the colour of polished anthracite, and only a fringe of startlingly white fluffy hair curling around his ears. "You really are to be congratulated." President Biddle was dancing with excitement, and I knew I'd be eating at Government House on guest nights again this season. It had taken a year or two, but the President had finally accepted me as though I was island-born. I was one of his children, with all the special privilege that this position carried with it. Fred Coker arrived in his hearse, but armed with his photographic equipment, and while he set up his tripod and disappeared under the black cloth to focus the ancient camera, we posed for him beside the colossal carcass. Chuck in the middle holding the rod, with the rest of us grouped round him, arms folded like a football team. Angelo and I were grinning, and Chubby was scowling horrifically into the lens. The picture would look good in my new advertising brochure. Loyal crew and intrepid skipper, hair curling out from under his cap and from the V of his shirt, all muscle and smiles. It would really pack him in next season. I arranged for the fish to go into the cold room down at the pineapple export sheds. I would consign it out to Roland Wards of London for mounting on the next refrigerated shipment. Then I left Angelo and Chubby to scrub down Dancer's decks, refuel her across the harbour at the Shell Basin, and take her out to moorings. As Chuck and I climbed into the cab of my battered old Ford pickup, Chubby sidled across like a racecourse tipster, speaking out of the corner of his mouth. "Harry, about my billfish bonus." I knew exactly what he was going to ask. We went through that every time. "Mrs. Chubby doesn't have to know about it, right?" I finished for him.
"That's right,"
he agreed lugubriously, and pushed his filthy deep-sea cap to the back of his head. I put Chuck on the plane at 9 the next morning, and I sang the whole way down from the plateau, honking the horn of my battered old Ford pickup at the island girls working in the pineapple fields. They straightened up with big flashing smiles under the brims of the wide straw hats and waved. At Coker's travel agency, I'd changed Chuck's American Express traveler's checks, haggling the rate of exchange with Fred Coker. He was in full fig, tailcoat and black tie. He had a funeral at noon. The camera and tripod laid up for the present, photographer became undertaker. Coker's funeral parlour was in the back of the travel agency, opening into the alley, and Fred used the hearse to pick up tourists at the airport, first discreetly changing his advertising board on the vehicle and putting the seats in over the rails for the coffins. I booked all my charters through him, and he clouted his 10% off my traveller's checks. He had the insurance agency as well, and he deducted the annual premium for Dancer before carefully counting out the balance. I recounted just as carefully, for though Fred looks like a schoolmaster, tall and thin and prim, with just enough island blood to give him a healthy all-over tan, he knows every trick in the book, and a few which haven't been written down yet. He waited patiently while I checked, taking no offence, and when I stuffed the roll into my back pocket, his gold pince-nez sparkled, and he told me like a loving father, "Don't forget you have a charter party coming in tomorrow, Mr. Harry." "Oh, that's all right, Mr. Coker, don't you worry. My crew'll be just fine." "They're done at the Lord Nelson already," he told me delicately. Fred keeps his finger firmly on the island's pulse. "Mr. Coker, I'm running a charter boat, not a temperance society." "Don't worry," I repeated and stood up. "Nobody ever yet died of a hangover." I crossed Drake Street to Edward's store and a hero's welcome. Ma Eddie herself came out from behind the counter and folded me into her warm, pneumatic bosom. "Mr. Harry," she cooed and bussed me, "I went down to the wharf to see the fish you hung yesterday." And then she turned, still holding me, and shouted at one of her counter girls, "Shirley, you get Mr. Harry a nice cold beer now, here?" I hauled out my roll. The pretty little island girls chittered like sparrows when they saw it, and Ma Eddie rolled her eyes and hugged me closer. "What do I owe you, Mrs. Eddie?" "From June to November is a long off-season, when the fish don't run, and Ma Eddie carries me through that lean time." I propped myself against the counter with a can of beer in my hand, picking the goods I needed from the shelves and watching their legs as the girls in their mini-skirts clambered up the ladders to fetch them down. Old Harry feeling pretty good and cocky, with that hard lump of green stuff in his back pocket. Then I went down to the Shell Company basin, and the manager met me at the door of his office between the big silver fuel storage tanks. "God, Harry, been waiting for you all morning. Head office screaming at me about your bill." "Your waiting is over, brother," I told him. But Wave Dancer, like most beautiful women, is an expensive mistress, and when I climbed back into the pickup, the lump in my pocket was severely depleted. They were waiting for me in the beer garden of the Lord Nelson. The island is very proud of its associations with the Royal Navy, despite the fact that it is no longer a British possession, but revels in an independence of 6 years' standing. Yet, for 200 years previously, it had been a station of the British fleet. Old prints, by long-dead artists, decorated the public bar, depicting the great ships beating up the channel or lying in Grand Harbour alongside Admiralty Wharf. Men of war and merchantmen of John Company, victualled and refitted here before the long run south to the Cape of Good Hope and the Atlantic. St. Mary's has never forgotten her place in history, nor the admirals and mighty ships that made their landfall here. The Lord Nelson is a parody of its former grandeur, but I enjoy its decayed and seedy elegance and its associations with the past more than the tower of glass and concrete that Hilton has erected on the headland above the harbour. Chubby and his wife sat side by side on the bench against the far wall, both of them in their Sunday clothes. This was the easiest way to tell them apart, the fact that Chubby wore the three-piece suit which he had bought for his wedding, the buttons straining and gaping, and the deep-sea cap stained with salt crystals and fish blood on his head, while his wife wore a full-length black dress of heavy wool, faded greenish with age, and black button-up boots beneath. Otherwise, their dark mahogany faces were almost identical, though Chubby was freshly shaven, and she did have a light moustache. "Hello, Mrs. Chubby, how are you?" I asked. "Thank you, Mr. Harry." "Will you take a little something, then? Perhaps just a little orange gin, Mr. Harry, with a small bitter to chase it down?" While she sipped the sweet liquor, I counted Chubby's wages into her hand, and her lips moved as she counted silently in chorus. Chubby watched anxiously, and I wondered once again how he had managed all these years to fool her on the billfish bonus. Mrs. Chubby drained the beer, and the froth emphasized her moustache. "I'll be off then, Mr. Harry." She rose majestically and sailed from the courtyard. I waited until she turned into Frobisher Street, before I slipped Chubby the little sheath of notes under the table, and we went into the private bar together. Angelo had a girl on each side of him and one on his lap. His black silk shirt was open to the belt buckle, exposing gleaming chest muscles. His denim pants fitted skin tight, leaving no doubt as to his gender, and his boots were hand-tooled and polished westerns. He had greased his hair and sleeked it back in the style of the young Presley. He flashed his grin like a stage lamp across the room, and when I paid him, he tucked a banknote into the front of each girl's blouse. "Hey, Eleanor, you go sit on Harry's lap, but careful now. Harry's a virgin. You treat him right here." He roared with delighted laughter and turned to Chubby. "Hey, Chubby, you quit giggling like that all the time, man. That's stupid, all that giggling and grinning." Chubby's frown deepened, his whole face crumpling into folds and wrinkles like that of a bulldog. "Hey, Mr. Barman, you give old Chubby a drink now. Perhaps that'll stop him cutting up stupid giggling like that." At 4 that afternoon, Angelo had driven his girls off, and he sat with his glass on the tabletop before him. Beside it lay his bait knife, honed to a razor edge and glinting evilly in the overhead lights. He muttered darkly to himself, deep in alcoholic melancholy. Every few minutes he would test the edge of the knife with his thumb and scowl around the room.
Nobody took any notice of him. Chubby sat on the other side of me, grinning like a great brown toad, exposing a set of huge, startlingly white teeth with pink plastic gums.
Harry, he told me expansively, one thick, muscled arm round my neck. You're a good boy, Harry. You know that?
Harry, I'm going to tell you now what I never done tell you before.
He nodded wisely as he gathered himself for the declaration he made every payday.
Harry, I'll love you, man. I'll love you better than my own brother.
I lifted the stained cap and lightly caressed the bald brown dome of his head.
And you, I told him, you are my favorite eggshell blonde.
He held me at arm's length for a moment, studying my face, and then burst into a lion's roar of laughter. It was completely infectious, and we were both still laughing when Fred Coker walked in and sat down at the table. He adjusted his pince-nez and said primly, Mr. Harry, I've just received a special delivery from London.
Your charter cancelled.
I stopped laughing.
What the hell? I said.
2 weeks without a charter in the middle of high season, and only a lousy $200 reservation fee.
Mr. Coker, you've got to get me a party.
I had $300 left in my pocket from Chuck's charter.
You've got to get me a party, I repeated.
And Angelo picked up his knife and with a crash drove the point deeply into the tabletop. Nobody took any notice of him, and he scowled angrily around the room.
I'll try, said Fred Coker, but it's a bit late now.
Cable the parties we had to turn down.
Who will pay for the cables?
Fred asked delicately.
Ah, the hell with it, I'll pay.
And he nodded and went out. I heard the hearse start up outside.
Don't worry, Harry, said Chubby. I still love you, man.
Suddenly beside me, Angelo went to sleep. He fell forward on his forehead, hit the tabletop with a resounding crack. I rolled his head so that he wouldn't drown in the puddle of spilt liquor, returned the knife to its sheath, and took charge of his bankroll to protect him from the girls who were hovering close.
Chubby ordered another round and began to sing a rambling, mumbling shanty in Island Patois, while I sat and worried. Once again, I was stretched out neatly on the financial rack. God, how I hate money, or rather the lack of it. Those 2 weeks would make all the difference as to whether or not Dancer and I could survive the off-season and still keep our good resolutions. I knew we couldn't. I knew we would have to go on the night run again.
How the hell with it? If we had to do it, we might as well do it now.
I'd passed the word that Harry was ready to do a deal. Having made the decision, I felt again that pleasurable tightening of the nerves, the gut thing that goes with danger. The 2 weeks of cancelled time might not be wasted after all. I joined Chubby in song, not entirely certain that we were singing the same number, for I seemed to reach the end of each chorus a long time before Chubby. It was probably this musical feast that called up the law. On St. Mary's, this takes the form of an inspector and four troopers, which is more than adequate for the island. Apart from a great deal of carnal knowledge under the edge of consent and a little wife-beating, there is no crime worthy of the name. Inspector Peter Daly was a young man with a blonde moustache, a high English colour on smooth cheeks, and pale blue eyes set close together like those of a sewer rat. He wore the uniform of the British Colonial Police, the cap with the silver badge and shiny patent leather peak, the khaki drill starched and ironed until it crackled softly as he walked, the polished leather belt and Sam Brown cross taps. He carried a Malacca cane swagger stick, which was also covered with polished leather. Except for the green and yellow St. Mary's shoulder flashes, he looked like the Empire's pride. But like the Empire, the men who wore the uniform had also crumbled.
Mr. Fletcher, he said, standing over our table and slapping the swagger stick lightly against his palm, I hope we're not going to have any trouble tonight.
Sir,
I prompted him. Inspector Daly and I were never friends. I don't like bullies, or persons who, in positions of trust, supplement a perfectly adequate salary with bribes and kickbacks. He had taken a lot of my hard-won gold from me in the past, which was his most unforgivable sin. His mouth hardened under the blonde moustache, and his colour came up quickly. "Sir," he repeated reluctantly. Now, it is true that once or twice in the remote past, Chubby and I had given way to an excess of boyish high spirits when we just hung a Moses fish. However, this did not give Inspector Daly any excuse for talking like that. He was, after all, a mere expatriate out on the island for a 3-year contract, which I knew from the President himself would not be renewed. "Inspector, am I correct in my belief that this is a public place, and that neither my friends nor I are committing a trespass?" "That is so." "Am I also correct in thinking that singing of tuneful and decent songs in a public place does not constitute a criminal act?" "Well, that's true, but..." "Inspector, piss off," I told him pleasantly. He hesitated, looking at Chubby and me. Between the two of us, we make up a lot of muscle, and he could see the unholy battle gleam in our eyes. You could also see that he wished he had had his troopers with him. "I'll be keeping an eye on you," he said, and clutching at his dignity like a beggar's rags, he left us. "Chubby, you sing like an angel," I said, and he beamed at me. "Harry, I'm going to buy you a drink." And Fred Coker arrived in time to be included in the round. He drank lager and lime juice, which turned my stomach a little, but his tidings were an effective antidote. "Mr. Harry, I got your party." "Mr. Coker, I love you." "I love you too," said Chubby. But deep down, I felt a twinge of disappointment. I'd been looking forward to another night run. "When are they arriving?" I asked. "They're here already. They were waiting for me at my office when I got back." "No kidding. They knew that your first party had cancelled, and they asked for you by name. They must have come in on the same plane as the special delivery." My thinking was a little muzzy right then, or I might have pondered a moment how neatly one party had withdrawn and another had stepped in. "They're staying up at the Hilton." "Do they want me to pick them up?" "No. They'll meet you at Admiralty Wharf 10 o'clock tomorrow morning." I was grateful that the party had asked for such a late starting time. That morning, Dancer was crewed by zombies. Angelo groaned and turned a light chocolate colour every time he bent over to coil a rope or rig the rods. And Chubby sweated neat alcohol, and his expression was truly terrifying. He hadn't spoken a word all the morning. I wasn't feeling all that cheerful myself. Dancer was snugged up alongside the wharf, and I leaned on the rail of the flying bridge with my darkest pair of Polaroids over my eyes, and although my scalp itched, I was afraid to take off my cap in case the top of my skull came with it. The island's single taxi, a 62 Citroen, came down Drake Street and stopped at the top of the wharf to deposit my party. There were two of them, and I'd expected three. Coker had definitely said a party of three. They started down the long stone-paved wharf, walking side by side, and I straightened up slowly as I watched them. I felt my physical distress fade into the realms of the inconsequential, to be replaced by that gut thing again, the slow coiling and clenching within, and the little tickling feeling along the back of my arms and in the nape of my neck. One was tall and walked with that loose, easy gait of a professional athlete. He was bareheaded and his hair was pale gingery and combed carefully across a prematurely balding pate, so the pink scalp showed through. However, he was lean around the belly and hips, and he was aware. It was the only word to describe the charged sense of readiness that emanated from him. It takes one to recognize one. This was a man trained to live with and by violence. He was muscle, a soldier in the jargon. It mattered not for which side of the law he exercised his skills, law enforcement or its frustration. He was very bad news. I had hoped never to see this kind of barracuda cruising St. Mary's placid waters. It gave me a sick little slide in the guts to know that it had found me out again. Quickly I glanced at the other man. It wasn't so obvious in him. The edge was blunted a little, the outline blurred by time and flesh. But it was there also. More bad news. Nice going, Harry, I told myself bitterly. All this, and a hangover thrown in. Clearly now I recognized that the older man was the leader. He walked half a pace ahead, the younger, taller man paying him that respect. He was a few years my senior also, probably late 30s. There was the beginnings of a paunch over the crocodile skin belt, and pouches of flesh along the line of his jawbone. But his hair had been styled in Bond Street, and he wore his sulker silk shirt and gutsy loafers like badges of rank. As he came down on the wharf, he dabbed at his chin and upper lip with a white handkerchief, and I guessed the diamond on his little finger at 2 carats. It was set in a plain gold ring, and the wristwatch was gold also, probably by Lanvin or Piaget. Fletcher, he asked, stooping below me on the jetty. His eyes were black and beady like those of a ferret, a predator's eyes, bright without warmth. I saw he was older than I'd guessed, for his hair was certainly tinted to conceal the grey. The skin of his cheeks was unnaturally tight, and I could see the scars of plastic surgery in the hairline. He'd had a facelift. A vain man, then. And I stored that bit of knowledge. He was an old soldier, risen from the ranks to a position of command. He was the brain, and the man that followed him was the muscle. Somebody had sent out their first team, and with a clairvoyant flash, I realized why my original party had cancelled. A phone call, followed by a visit from this pair, would put the average citizen off marlin fishing for life. They had probably done themselves a serious injury in their rush to cancel. Mr. Madison, come aboard. One thing was certain. They had not come for the fishing. And I decided on a low and humble profile until I'd figured out the percentages. So I threw in a belated sir. The muscle man jumped down to the deck, landing soft-footed like a cat. And I saw the way that the folded coat over his arm swung heavily. There was something weighty in the pocket. He confronted my crew, thrusting out his jaw and running his eyes over them swiftly. Angelo flashed a watered-down version of the celebrated smile and touched the brim of his cap. "Welcome, sir." And Chubby's scowl lightened momentarily, and he muttered something that sounded like a curse, but was probably a warm greeting. The man ignored them and turned to hand Matteson down to the deck, where he waited while his bodyguard checked out Dancer's main saloon. Then he went in and I followed him. Our accommodation is luxurious. At 125,000 nicker it should be. The air conditioning had taken the bite out of the morning heat, and Matteson sighed with relief and dabbed again with his handkerchief as he sank into one of the padded seats. "This is Mike Guthrie." He indicated the muscle, who was moving about the cabin, checking at the ports, opening doors and generally overplaying his hand, coming on very tough and hard. "My pleasure, Mr. Guthrie." And I grinned with all my boyish charm, and he waved airily without glancing at me. "A drink, gentlemen?" I asked, as I opened the liquor cabinet. They took a Coke each, but I needed something medicinal for the shock and the hangover. The first swallow of cold beer from the can revitalized me. "Well, gentlemen, I think I shall be able to offer you some sport.
Only yesterday I hung a very good fish. And all the signs are for a big run, so...
Mike Guthrie stepped in front of me and stared into my face. His eyes were flecked and with brown and pale green, like a handsome hand-loom tweed.
"Don't I know you?"
he asked.
"I don't think I've ever had the pleasure."
"You are a London boy, aren't you?" He'd picked up the accent.
"I left Blighty a long time ago, mate," I'd grinned, letting it come out broad.
He did not smile, and dropped into the seat opposite me, placing his hands on the tabletop between us, spreading his fingers palm downwards. He continued to stare at me. A very tough baby. Very hard.
"I'm afraid it's too late for today," I babbled on cheerfully. "If we're going to fish in the Mozambique, we have to clear harbour by 6 o'clock. However, we can make an early start tomorrow."
Matteson interrupted my chatter.
"Check that list out, Fletcher, and let us know what you were short."
He passed me a folded sheet of foolscap, and I glanced down the handwritten column. It was all scuba diving gear and salvage equipment.
"Oh, you gentlemen aren't interested in big-game fishing, then?"
Old Harry showing surprise and amazement at such an unlikely eventuality.
"We've come out to do a little exploring, that's all."
I shrugged.
"Well, you're paying. We do what you want to do." "Have you got all that stuff?"
"Most of it. In the off-season, I run a cut-rate package deal for scuba buffs, which helps pay expenses. I had a full range of diving sets, and there was an air compressor built into Dancer's engine room for recharging. I don't have the airbags or all that rope."
"Can you get them?"
"Oh, sure. Ma Eddie had a pretty good selection of ship stores, and Angelo's old man was a sailmaker. He could run up the airbags in a couple of hours."
"Right, then. Get it."
I nodded.
"When do you want to start?"
"Tomorrow morning. There will be one other person with us."
"Did Mr. Coker tell you it's $500 a day? And I'll have to charge you for this extra equipment."
Matteson inclined his head and made as if to rise.
"Would it be okay to see a little of that out front?"
I asked softly. And they froze. I grinned ingratiatingly.
"It's been a long, lean winter, Mr. Matteson, and I've got to buy this stuff and fill my fuel tanks."
Matteson took out his wallet and counted out £300 in fivers. As he was doing so, he said in his soft, purry voice,
"We won't need your crew, Fletcher. The three of us will help you handle the boat."
I was taken aback. I hadn't expected that. "They'll have to draw full wages if we'll lay them off. I can't reduce my rate."
Mike Guthrie was still sitting opposite me, and now he leaned forward.
"You heard the man, Fletcher? Just get your niggers off the boat," he said softly.
Carefully, I folded the bundle of £5 notes and buttoned them into my breast pocket. Then I looked at him. He was very quick. I could see him tense up, ready for me. And for the first time he showed expression in those cold, speckled eyes. It was anticipation. He knew he had reached me, and he thought I was going to try him. He wanted that. He wanted to take me apart. He left his hands on the table, palm downwards, fingers spread. I thought how I might take the little finger of each hand and snap them at the middle joint like a pair of cheese sticks. I knew I could do it before he had a chance to move. And the knowledge gave me a great deal of pleasure, for I was very angry. I haven't many friends, but I value the few I have.
"Did you hear me speak, boy?"
Guthrie hissed at me. And I dredged up the boyish grin again and let it hang at a ridiculous angle on my face.
"Yes, sir, Mr. Guthrie," I said. "You're paying the money, whatever you say."
I nearly choked on the words. He leaned back in his seat, and I saw that he was disappointed. He was muscle, and he enjoyed his work. I think I knew then that I was going to kill him, and I took enough comfort from the thought to enable me to hold the grin. Matteson was watching us with those bright little eyes. His interest was detached and clinical, like a scientist studying a pair of laboratory specimens. He saw that the confrontation had been resolved for the present, and his voice was soft and purry again.
"Very well, Fletcher." He moved towards the deck. "Get that equipment together and be ready for us at 8 tomorrow morning."
I let them go, and I sat and finished the beer. It may have been just my hangover, but I was beginning to have a very ugly feeling about this whole charter, and I realized that after all it might be best to leave Chubby and Angelo ashore. I went out to tell them. "We've got a pair of freaks. I'm sorry, but they've got some big secret, and they're dealing you out." I put the Aqualung bottles on the compressor to top up, and we left Dancer at the wharf while I went up to Ma Eddie's, and Angelo and Chubby took my drawings of the airbags across to his father's workshop. The bags were ready by 4 o'clock, and I picked them up in the Ford and stowed them in the sail locker under the cockpit seats. Then I spent an hour stripping and reassembling the demand valves of the scubas and checking out all the other diving equipment. At sundown, I ran Dancer out to her moorings on my own, and was about to leave her and row ashore in the dinghy, when I had a good thought. I went back into the cabin and knocked back the toggles on the engine room hatch. I took the FN carbine from its hiding place, pumped a cartridge into the breech, set her for automatic fire, and clicked on the safety catch before hanging her in the slings again. Before it was dark, I took my old cast net and waded out across the lagoon towards the main reef. I saw the swirl and run beneath the surface of the water, which the setting sun had burnished to the colour of copper and flame. And I sent the net spinning high with a swing of shoulders and arms. It ballooned like a parachute and fell in a wide circle over the shoal of striped mullet. When I pulled the drag line and closed the net over them, there were 5 of the big silvery fish as long as my forearm, kicking and thumping in the coarse wet folds. I grilled 2 of them and ate them on the veranda of my shack. They tasted better than trout from a mountain stream. And afterwards I poured a 2nd whiskey and sat on into the dark. Usually this is the time of day when the island enfolds me in a great sense of peace, and I seem to understand what the whole business of living is all about. However, that night was not like that. I was angry that these people had come out to the island and brought with them their special brand of poison to contaminate us. 5 years ago, I had run from that, believing I'd found a place that was safe. Yet, beneath the anger, when I was honest with myself, I recognized also an excitement, a pleasurable excitement. That gut thing again, knowing that I was at risk once more. I was not sure yet what the stakes were, but I knew they were high, and that I was sitting in the game with the big boys once again. I was on the left-hand path again, the path I'd chosen at 17, when I had deliberately decided against the university bursary which I'd been awarded, and instead I bunked from St. Stephen's Orphanage in North London, lied about my age to join a whaling factory ship bound for the Antarctic. Down there, on the edge of the great ice, I lost my last vestige of appetite for the academic life. When the money I had made in the South ran out, I enlisted in a special service battalion, where I learnt how violence and sudden death could be practised as an art. I practised that art in Malaya and Vietnam, and then later in the Congo and Biafra. Until suddenly one day,
in a remote jungle village, while the thatched huts burnt, sending columns of tarry black smoke into an empty brazen sky, and the flies came to the dead in humming blue clouds. I was sickened to the depths of my soul. I wanted out. In the South Atlantic, I'd come to love the sea, and now I wanted a place beside it, with a boat, and peace in the long, quiet evenings. First, I needed money to buy those things, a great deal of money. So much that the only way I could earn it was in the practice of my art. One last time, I thought, and I planned it with the utmost care. I needed an assistant, and I chose a man I'd known in the Congo. Between us, we lifted the complete collection of gold coins from the British Museum of Numismatology in Belgrave Square. 3,000 rare gold coins that fitted easily into a medium-sized briefcase. Coins of the Roman Caesars and the emperors of Byzantium. Coins of the early states of America and of the English kings. Florins and leopards of Edward III. Nobles of the Henrys and angels of Edward IV. Treble sovereigns and unites. Crowns of the rose from the reign of Henry VIII. And £5 pieces of George III and Victoria. 3,000 coins worth, even on a forced sale, not less than $2 million. Then I made my first mistake as a professional criminal. I trusted another criminal. When I caught up with my assistant in an Arab hotel in Beirut, I reasoned with him in fairly strong terms. And when finally I put the question to him of just what he had done with the briefcase of coins, he snatched a .38 Beretta from under his mattress. In the ensuing scuffle, he had his neck broken. It had been a mistake. I didn't mean to kill the man. But even more, I didn't mean him to kill me. I hung a "Don't Disturb" sign on his door, and I caught the next plane out. 10 days later, the police found the briefcase with the coins in the left luggage department at Paddington Station. It made the front page of all the national newspapers. I tried again at an exhibition of cut diamonds in Amsterdam, but I'd done a faulty research on the electronic alarm system, and I tripped a beam that I'd overlooked. The plainclothes security guards who'd been hired by the organizers of the exhibition rushed headlong into the uniformed police coming in through the main entrance, and a spectacular shootout ensued, while a completely unarmed Harry Fletcher slunk away into the night to the sound of loud cries and gunfire. I was halfway to Schiphol Airport by the time a ceasefire was called between the opposing forces of the law, but not before a sergeant of the Dutch police received a critical chest wound. I sat anxiously chewing my nails and drinking innumerable beers in my room in the Holiday Inn near Zurich Airport as I followed the gallant sergeant's fight for life on the television set. I would have hated like all hell to have another fatality on my conscience. And I made a solemn vow that if the policeman died, I would forget forever about my place in the sun. However, the Dutch sergeant rallied strongly, and I felt an immense proprietary pride in him when he was finally declared out of danger. And when he was promoted to assistant inspector and awarded a bonus of 5,000 crowns, I persuaded myself that I was his fairy godfather and that the man owed me eternal gratitude. Still, I had been shaken by two failures, and I took a job as an instructor at an outward bound school for 6 months while I considered my future. At the end of 6 months, I decided for one more try. This time, I laid the groundwork with meticulous care. I emigrated to South Africa, where I was able, with my qualifications, to obtain a post as an operator with a security firm responsible for bullion shipments from the South African Reserve Bank in Pretoria to overseas destinations. For a year, I worked with the transportation of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of gold bars, and I studied the system in every minute detail. The weak spot, when I found it, was at Rome. But again, I needed help. This time, I went to the professionals, but I set my price at a level that made it easier for them to pay me out than to put me down. And I covered myself 100 times against treachery. It went as smoothly as I had planned it. And this time there were no victims. Nobody came out with a bullet or a cracked skull. We merely switched part of a cargo and substituted lead cases. Then we moved 2.5 tons of gold bars across the Swiss border in a furniture removals van. In Bâle, sitting in a banker's private rooms furnished with priceless antiques, above the wide, swift waters of the Rhine on which the stately white swans rode in majesty, they paid me out. Manny Resnick signed the transfer into my numbered account of £150,000, and he laughed, a fat, hungry little laugh. "You'll be back, Harry. You've tasted blood now. You'll be back. Have a nice holiday, and then come to me again when you've thought up another deal like this one." He was wrong. I never went back. I rode up to Zurich in a hire car and flew to Paris early. In the men's room there, I shaved off the beard and picked up the briefcase from the pay locker that contained the passport in the name of Harold Delville Fletcher. Then I flew out Pan Am for Sydney, Australia. Wave Dancer cost me £125,000. And I took under a deck load of fuel drums across to St. Mary's 2,000 miles, a voyage on which we learnt to love each other. On St. Mary's, I purchased 25 acres of peace and built the shack with my own hands, 4 rooms, a thatched roof and a wide veranda, set amongst the palms above the white beach. Except for the occasions when a night run had been forced upon me, I'd walked the right-hand path since then. It was late when I'd done my reminiscences, and the tide was pushing high up the beach in the moonlight before I went into the shack. But then I slept like an innocent. They were on time the following morning. Charlie Matteson ran a tight outfit. The taxi deposited them at the head of the wharf, while I had Dancer singled up at stem and stern and both engines burbling sweetly. I watched them come, concentrating on the third member of the group. He was not what I'd expected. He was tall and lean, with a wide, friendly face and dark, soft hair. Unlike the others, his face and arms were darkly suntanned, and his teeth were large and very white. He wore denim shorts and a white sweatshirt, and he had a swimmer's wide, rangy shoulders and powerful arms. I knew instantly who was to use the diving equipment. He carried a big green canvas kit bag over one shoulder. He carried it easily, though I could see that it was weighty. And he chatted gaily with his 2 companions, who answered him in monosyllables. They flanked him like a pair of guards. He looked up at me as they came level, and I saw that he was young and eager. There was an excitement, an anticipation about him, that reminded me sharply of myself 10 years previously. "Hi," he grinned at me. An easy, friendly grin, and I realized that he was an extremely good-looking youngster. "Greetings," I replied, liking him from the first, and intrigued as to how he had found a place with the wolf pack. Under my direction, they took in the mooring lines, and from this brief exercise, I learned that the youngster was the only one of them familiar with small boats. As we cleared the harbor, he and Matteson came up onto the flying bridge. Matteson had coloured slightly, and his breathing was raggedy from the mild exertion. He introduced the newcomer. "This is Jimmy," he told me when he'd caught his breath. We shook hands, and I put his age at not much over 20. Close up, I had no cause to revise my first impressions. He had a level and innocent gaze from sea-grey eyes, and his grip was firm and dry. "She's a darling boat, skipper," he told me, which was rather like telling a mother that her baby is beautiful. "Oh, she's not a bad old girl. What is she, 44, 45 feet? 45, I said, liking him a little more. "Jimmy will give you your directions," Matteson told me. "You will follow his orders." "Fine," I said. And Jimmy coloured a little under his tan. "Not orders, Mr. Fletcher. I'll just tell you where we want to go." Fine, Jim. I'll take you there.
Once we're clear of the island, will you turn due west?
Just how far in that direction do you intend going? I asked.
We want to cruise along the coast of the African mainland.
Oh, lovely, I said. That's great. Did anybody tell you that they don't hang out the welcome mat for strangers there?
We will stay well offshore, said Matheson.
I thought a moment, hesitating before turning back to Admiralty Wharf and packing the whole bunch ashore.
Where do you want to go? North or south of the river mouth?
North, said Jimmy.
And that altered the proposition for the good. South of the river, they patrolled with helicopters and were very touchy about their territorial waters. I wouldn't go in there during daylight. In the north, there was little coastal activity. There was a single crash boat at Zimbala, but when its engines were in running order, which was a few days a week, then its crew were mostly blown out of their minds with the virulent palm liquor brewed locally along the coast. When crew and engines were functioning simultaneously, they could raise 15 knots. And Dancer could turn on 22 any time I asked her. The final trick in my favour was that I could run Dancer through the maze of offshore reefs and islands on a dark night in a roaring monsoon, while it was my experience that the crash boat commander avoided this sort of extravagance. Even on a bright sunny day and a flat calm, he preferred the quiet and peace of Zimbala Bay. I had heard that he suffered acutely from seasickness and held his present appointment only because it was far away from the capital, where, as a minister of the government, the commander had been involved in a little unpleasantness regarding the disappearance of large amounts of foreign aid. From my point of view, he was the ideal man for the job.
All right, I agreed, turning to Matheson. But I'm afraid what you're asking is going to cost you another $250 a day.
Danger money.
I was afraid that it might, he said softly. I brought the Dancer around, close to the light on Oyster Point. It was a bright morning with a high, clear sky, into which the stationary clouds that marked the position of each group of islands towered in great, soft columns of blinding white. The solemn progress of the trade winds across the ocean was interrupted by the bulwark of the African continent on which they broke. We were getting the backlash here in the inshore channel, and random squalls and gusts of it spread darkly across the pale green waters and flecked the surface chop with white. Dancer loved it. It gave her an excuse to flounce and swish her bottom.
You looking for anything special, or just looking? I asked casually.
And Jimmy turned to tell me all about it. He was itchy with excitement, and the grey eyes sparkled as he opened his mouth.
"Just looking," Matheson interrupted with a ring in his voice and a sharp warning in his expression, and Jimmy's mouth closed. "I know these waters. I know every island, every reef, and I might be able to save you a lot of time, and a bit of money."
"That's very kind of you,"
Matheson thanked me with heavy irony. "However, I believe we can manage."
"Oh, you're paying," I shrugged, and Matheson glanced at Jimmy, inclined his head in a command to follow, and led him down into the cockpit. They stood together beside the stern rail, and Matheson spoke to him quietly but earnestly for 2 minutes. I saw Jimmy flush darkly, his expression changing from dismay to boyish sulks, and I guessed that he was having his ear chewed to ribbons on the subject of secrecy and security. When he came back onto the flying bridge, he was seething with anger. And for the first time I noticed the strong, hard line of his jaw. He wasn't just a pretty boy, I decided. Evidently, on Matheson's orders, Guthrie, the muscle, came out of the cabin and swung the big, padded fighting chair to face the bridge. He lounged in it, even in his relaxation, charged with the promise of violence like a resting leopard. And he watched us, one leg draped over the armrest and the linen jacket, with the heavy weight in its pocket, folded in his lap. A happy ship, I chuckled, and ran Dancer out through the islands, threading a fine course through the clear green waters, where the reefs lurked darkly below the surface like malevolent monsters, and the islands were fringed with coral sand as dazzling white as a snowdrift, and crowned with dark, thick vegetation, over which the palm stems curved gracefully, their tops shaking in the feeble remnants of the trade. It was a long day as we cruised at random, and I tried to get some hint of the object of the expedition. However, still smarting from Matteson's reprimand, Jim was tight-mouthed and grim. He asked for changes of course at intervals, after I'd pointed out our position on the large-scale Admiralty chart which he produced from his bag. Although there were no extraneous markings on his chart, when I examined it surreptitiously, I was able to figure that we were interested in an area 15 to 30 miles north of the multiple mouths of the Rovuma River and up to 16 miles offshore, an area containing perhaps 300 islands, varying in size from a few acres to many square miles. A very big haystack in which to find his needle. I was content enough to perch up on Dancer's bridge and run quietly along the seaways, enjoying the feel of my darling under me and watching the activity of the sea animals and birds. In the fighting chair, Mike Guthrie's scalp started to show through the thin cover of hair like strips of scarlet neon lighting. All right, cook, you bastard, I thought happily, and neglected to warn him about the tropical sun until we were running home in the dusk. The next day, he was in agony, with white goo smeared over his bloated and incarnadined features, and with a wide cloth hat covering his head. But his face flashed like the port light of an ocean-goer. By noon on the second day, I was bored. Jimmy was poor company, for although he'd recovered a little of his good humour, he was so conscious of security that he even thought for 30 seconds before accepting an offer of coffee. It was more for something to do than because I wanted fish for my dinner that when I saw a squadron of small kingfish charging a big shoal of sardine ahead of us, I gave the wheel to Jimmy. "Just keep her on that heading," I told him, and dropped down into the cockpit. Guthrie watched me warily from his swollen crimson face as I glanced into the cabin and saw that Master Matteson had my bar open and was mixing himself a gin and tonic. At 750 a day, I didn't grudge it to him. He hadn't emerged from the cabin in 2 days. I went back to the small tackle locker and selected a pair of feather jigs and tossed them out. As we crossed the track of the shoal, I hit a kingfish and brought him out kicking, flashing golden in the sun. Then I recoiled the lines and stowed them, wiped the blade of my heavy bait knife across the oilstone to brighten up the edge, and split the kingfish's belly from anal vent to gills, and pulled out a handful of bloody gut to throw it into the wake. Immediately, a pair of gulls that had been weaving and hovering over us screeched with greed and plunged for the scraps. Their excitement summoned others, and within minutes there was a shrieking, flapping host of them astern of us. Their din was not so loud that it covered the metallic snicker close behind me. The unmistakable sound of the slide on an automatic pistol being drawn back and released to load and cock. I moved entirely from instinct. Without thought, the big bait knife spun in my right hand as I changed smoothly to a throwing grip, and I turned and dropped to the deck in a single movement, breaking fall with heels and left arm as the knife went back over my right shoulder, and I began the throw at the instant that I lined up the target. Mike Guthrie had a big automatic in his right hand, an old-fashioned naval 4.5, a killer's weapon, one which would blow a hole in a man's chest through which you could drive a London cab. Two things saved Guthrie from being pinned to the back of the fighting chair by the long, heavy blade of the bait knife. Firstly, the fact that the 45 was not pointed at me. And secondly, the expression of comical amazement on the man's scarlet face. I prevented myself from throwing the knife, breaking the instinctive action by a major effort of will. And we stared at each other. He knew then how close he'd come,
and the grin he forced to his swollen, sunburnt lips was shaky and unconvincing. I stood up and pegged the knife into the bait chopping board.
"Do yourself a favor," I told him quietly. "Don't play with that thing behind my back."
He laughed then, blustering and tough again. He swiveled the seat and aimed out over the stern. He fired twice, the shots crashing out loudly above the run of Dancer's engines, and the brief smell of cordite was whipped away on the wind. Two of the milling gulls exploded into grotesque bursts of blood and feathers, blown to shreds by the heavy bullets, and the rest of the flock scattered with shrieks of panic. The manner in which the birds were torn up told me that Guthrie had loaded with explosive bullets, a more savage weapon than a sawn-off shotgun. He swiveled the chair back to face me and blew into the muzzle of the pistol like John Wayne. It was fancy shooting with that heavy-caliber weapon. "Tough cookie," I applauded him, and turned to the bridge ladder. But Matteson was standing in the doorway of the cabin with the gin in his hand. And as I stepped past him, he spoke quietly. "Now I know who you are," he said in that soft, purry voice. "It's been worrying us. We thought we knew you." I stared at him, and he called past me to Guthrie. "You know who he is now, don't you?" And Guthrie shook his head. I don't think he could trust his voice. He had a beard then, think about it. A mugshot photograph. "Jesus," said Guthrie. "Harry Bruce." I felt a little shock at hearing the name spoken out loud again after all these years. I had hoped it was forgotten forever.
"Rome," said Matteson. "The gold heist."
"He set it up." Guthrie snapped his fingers.
"I was sure I knew him. It was the beard that fooled me."
"I see you gentlemen have the wrong address," I said with a desperate attempt at a cool tone, but was thinking quickly, trying to weigh this fresh knowledge. They had seen a mugshot? Where? When? Were they lawmen, or from the other side of the fence? I needed time to think, and I clambered up to the bridge.
"Sorry," muttered Jimmy, as I took the wheel from him. "I should have told you we had a gun."
"Yes," I said. "It might have helped."
My mind was racing, and the first turning it took was along the left-hand path. They would have to go. They had blown my elaborate cover. They'd sniffed me out. And there was only one sure way. I looked back into the cockpit, but both Matteson and Guthrie had gone below. An accident? Take them both out at one stroke? Aboard a small boat, there were plenty of ways a greenhorn could get hurt in the worst possible way. They had to go. Then I looked at Jimmy, and he grinned at me.
"You move fast," he said. "Mike nearly wet himself. He thought he was going to get that knife through his gizzard."
"The kid also?" I asked myself. "If I took out the other two, he would have to go as well." And then suddenly I felt the same physical nausea that I'd first known long ago in the Biafran village.
"You okay, Skipper?"
Jimmy asked quickly. It had shown on my face.
"Yes, I'm okay, Jim," I said. "Why don't you go fetch us a can of beer?"
While he was below, I reached my decision. I would do a deal. I was certain that they didn't want their business shouted in the streets. I'd trade secrecy for secrecy. Probably they were coming to the same conclusion in the cabin below. I locked the wheel and crossed quietly to the corner of the bridge, making sure my footsteps were not picked up on the cabin below. The ventilator there funnels fresh air into the inlet above the saloon table, and I'd found that the ventilator made a reasonably effective voice tube. That sound was carried through it to the bridge. However, the effectiveness of this listening device depends, of course, on a number of factors, chief of these being the direction and strength of the wind and the precise position of the speaker in the cabin below. The wind was on our beam, gusting into the opening of the ventilator and blotting out patches of the conversation in the cabin.
However, Jimmy must have been standing directly below the vent, for his voice came through strongly when the wind roar didn't smother it. "Why don't you ask him now?" And the reply was confused. And then the wind gusted, and when it cleared, Jimmy was speaking again. "If you do it tonight, where will you..." And the wind roared. "To get the dawn light, then we'll have to..." The entire discussion seemed to be on times and places, and as I wondered briefly what they hoped to gain by leaving harbour at dawn, he said it again. "If the dawn light is where..." I strained for the next words, but the wind killed them for 10 seconds, and then... "I don't see why we can't," Jimmy was protesting, and suddenly Mike Guthrie's voice came through sharp and hard. He must have gone to stand close beside Jimmy, probably in a threatening attitude. "Listen, Jimmy boy, you let us handle that side of it. Your job's to find the bloody thing, and you aren't doing so good this far." They must have moved again, for their voices became indistinct, and I heard the sliding door into the cockpit opening, and I turned quickly to the wheel and freed the retaining handle, just as Jimmy's head appeared over the edge of the deck as he came up the ladder. He handed me the beer, and he seemed to be more relaxed now. The reserve was gone from his manner. He smiled at me, friendly and trusting. "Mr. Madison says that's enough for today. We're to head for home." I swung Dancer across, and the current and we came in from the west past the mouth of Turtle Bay, and I could see my shack standing amongst the palms. I felt a sudden, chilling premonition of loss. The fates had called for a new deck of cards, and the game was bigger, the stakes were too rich for my blood. But there was no way I could pull out now. However, I suppressed the chill of despair and turned to Jimmy. I would take advantage of his new attitude of trust and try for what information I could glean. We chatted lightly on the run down the channel into Grand Harbour. They had obviously told him that I was off the leper list. Strangely, the fact that I had a criminal past made me more acceptable to the wolf pack. They could reckon the angles now. They'd found a lever, so now they could handle me. Though I was pretty sure they had not explained the whole proposition to young James. It was obviously a relief for him to act naturally with me. He was a friendly and open person, completely lacking in guile. An example of this was the way that his surname had been guarded like a military secret from me. And yet around his neck he wore a silver chain and a medic alert tag that warned that J.A. North, the wearer, was allergic to penicillin. Now he forgot all his former reserve, and gently I drew small snippets of information from him that I might have use for in the future. In my experience, it's what you don't know that can really hurt you. I chose the subject that I guessed would open him up completely. "Do you see that reef across the channel? There, where she's breaking now? That's Devilfish Reef, and there's 20 fathoms sheer under the seaside of her. It's a hangout of some real big old bull grouper. I shot one there last year that weighed in at over 200 kilos. 200? My God!" he exclaimed. "That's almost 450 pounds. "Right. You could put your head and shoulders in his mouth." The last of his reserves disappeared. He'd been reading history and philosophy at Cambridge, but spent too much time in the sea and had to drop out. Now he ran a small diving equipment supply company, an underwater salvage outfit, that gave him a living and allowed him to dive most days of the week. He did private work and had contracted to the government and the Navy on some jobs. More than once he mentioned the name Sherry, and I probed carefully. "Girlfriend or wife?" And he grinned. "Sister. Big sister. But she's a doll. She does the books and minds the shop, all that stuff." In a tone that left no doubt as to what James thought about bookkeeping and counter-jumping. "She's a red-hot conchologist, and she makes 2,000 a year out of her seashells." But he didn't explain how he'd got into the dubious company he was now keeping, nor what he was doing halfway around the world from his sport shop. I left them on Admiralty Wharf and took Dancer over to the Shell Basin for refueling before dark.
That evening I grilled the kingfish over the coals, roasted a couple of big sweet yams in their jackets, and was washing it down with a cold beer, sitting on the veranda of the shack and listening to the surf, when I saw the headlights coming down through the palm trees. The taxi parked beside my pickup, and the driver stayed at the wheel while his passengers came up the steps onto the stoop. They'd left James at the Hilton, and there were just the two of them now, Matteson and Guthrie. "Drink?" I indicated the bottles and ice on the side table. Guthrie poured gin for both of them, and Matteson sat opposite me and watched me finish the last of the fish.
"I made a few phone calls," he said when I pushed my plate away, "and they tell me that Harry Bruce disappeared in June 5 years ago and hasn't been heard of since. I asked around and found that Harry Fletcher sailed into Grand Harbour here 3 months later, inward bound from Sydney, Australia." "Is that the truth?"
I picked a little fishbone out of my tooth and lit a long black island cheroot.
"One other thing, someone who knew him well tells me. Harry Bruce had a knife scar on his left arm." He purred,
and I involuntarily glanced at the thin line of scar tissue that laced the muscle of my forearm. It had shrunk and flattened with the years, but it was still very white against the dark sun-brown skin.
"Oh, that's a hell of a coincidence," I said, and drew on the cheroot.
It was strong and aromatic, tasting of sea and sun and spices.
I wasn't worried now. They were going to make a deal.
"Yeah, isn't it?" Matteson agreed, and he looked round him elaborately.
"You got a nice setup here, Fletcher. Cozy, isn't it? Really nice and cozy."
"Well, it beats hell out of working for a living," I admitted.
"Or out of breaking rocks, or sewing mailbags.
I should imagine it does."
"The kid is going to ask you some questions tomorrow. Be nice to him, Fletcher. When we go, you can forget you ever saw us. And we'll forget to tell anybody about that funny coincidence."
"Mr. Matteson, sir, I've got a terrible memory," I assured him. After the conversation I had overheard in Dancer's cabin, I expected them to ask for an early start the following morning, for the dawn light seemed important to their plans. However, neither of them mentioned it, and when they'd gone, I knew I wouldn't sleep. So I walked out along the sand round the curve of the bay to Mutton Point to watch the moon come up through the palm trees. I sat there until after midnight. The dinghy was gone from the jetty, but Hambone, the ferryman, rowed me out to Dancer's moorings before sunup the following morning, and as we came alongside I saw the familiar shape shambling around the cockpit and the dinghy tied alongside.
"Hey, Chubby," I jumped aboard. "Your missus kick you out of bed, then?"
Dancer's deck was gleaming white even in the bad light, and all the metalwork was brightly burnished. He must have been at it for a couple of hours. Chubby loves Dancer almost as much as I do.
"She looked like a public shithouse, Harry," he grumbled. "That's a sloppy bunch you got aboard."
And he spat noisily over the side.
"No respect for a boat, that's what."
He had coffee ready for me, as strong and as pungent as only he can make it, and we drank it sitting in the saloon. Chubby frowned heavily into his mug and blew on the steaming black liquid. He wanted to tell me something.
"How's Angelo?" "Pleasuring the Rowana widows," he growled.
The island does not provide sufficient employment for all its able-bodied young men, so most of them ship out on 3-year labour contracts to the American Satellite Tracking Station, an air force based on Rowano Island. They leave their young wives behind, the Rowano widows, and the island girls are justly celebrated for the high temperature of their blood and their friendly dispositions.
"That Angelo's going to shag his brain loose. He's been at it night and day since Monday."
I thought I detected more than a trace of envy in his growl. Mrs. Chubby kept him on a pretty tight lead. He sipped noisily at the coffee.
How's your party, Harry?
Oh, their money's good.
You're not fishing, Harry. He looked at me. I watch you from Cooley Peak, man. You don't go near the channel. You working inshore.
That's right, Chubby.
It returned his attention to his coffee. Hey, Harry, you watch them. You be good and careful. Hear? They bad men, those two. I don't know the young one, but the others, bad. I'll be careful, Chubby. You know new girl at the hotel, Marion? The one over for the season?
I nodded. She was a pretty slim little wisp of a girl with lovely long legs, about 19, with glossy black hair, freckled skin, bold eyes, and an impish smile.
Well, last night, she went with the blonde one, the one with red face.
I knew that Marion sometimes combined business with pleasure and provided for selected hotel guests services beyond the call of duty. On the island, this sort of activity drew no social stigma.
Yes, I encouraged Chubby. He hurt her. Harry hurt her bad.
Chubby took another mouthful of coffee.
Then he paid her so much money, she couldn't go to the police.
I liked Mike Guthrie a little less now. Only an animal would take advantage of a girl like Marion. I knew her well. She had an innocence, a childlike acceptance of life that made her promiscuity strangely appealing. I remembered how I'd thought I might have to kill Guthrie one day, and tried not to let that thought perish.
They're bad men, Harry. I thought it best you know that.
Thanks, Chubby.
And don't you let them dirty up Dancer like that, he added accusingly. Saloon deck, like a pigsty man.
He helped me run Dancer across to Admiralty Wharf, and then he set off homewards, grumbling and muttering blackly. He passed Jimmy coming in the opposite direction and shot him a single malevolent glance that should have shriveled him in his tracks. Jimmy was on his own, fresh-faced and jaunty. "Hi, Skipper," he called, as he jumped down onto Dancer's deck, and I went into the saloon with him and poured coffee for us. "Mr. Matteson says you have some questions for me, is that right?"
"Look, Mr. Fletcher, I want you to know that I didn't mean offence by not talking to you before. It wasn't me, but the others."
"Ah, sure," I said, "that's fine, Jimmy. It would have been the sensible thing to ask your help long ago, instead of blundering around the way we have been. Anyway, now the others have suddenly decided it's okay." He had just told me much more than he imagined, and I adjusted my opinion of Master James. It was clear that he possessed information, and he had not shared it with the others. It was his insurance, and he'd probably insisted on seeing me alone to keep his insurance policy intact.
"Skipper, we're looking for an island. A specific island.
I can't tell you why. I'm sorry."
"Oh, forget it, Jimmy. That's all right."
"What will there be for you, James North?" I wondered suddenly.
"What will the wolf pack have for you once you've led them to this special island of yours? Will it be something a lot less pleasant than penicillin allergy?" I looked at that handsome young face and felt an unaccustomed flood of affection for him. Perhaps it was his youth and innocence, the sense of excitement with which he viewed this tired and wicked old world. I envied and liked him for that, and I did not relish seeing him pulled down and rolled in the dirt.
"Jim, how well do you know your friends?" I asked him quietly. And he was taken by surprise, and then almost immediately he was wary.
"Well enough," he replied carefully. "Why?"
"You've known them less than a month," I said, as though I knew, and saw the confirmation in his expression. "And I've known men like that all my life."
"I don't see what this has to do with it, Mr. Fletcher." He was stiffening up now. I was treating him like a child, and he didn't like that.
"Listen, Jim, forget this business, whatever it is. Drop it, and go back to your shop and your salvage company.
That's crazy, he said. You don't understand.
I understand, Jim, I really do. I traveled the same road, and I know it well.
I can look after myself. Don't worry about me.
He had flushed up under his tan, and the grey eyes snapped with defiance. We stared at each other for a few moments, and I knew I was wasting time and emotion. If anyone had spoken like this to me at the same age, I would have thought him senile.
All right, Jim, I said. I'll drop it.
But you know the score. Just play it cool and loose. That's all.
Okay, Mr. Fletcher.
He relaxed slowly, and then grinned a charming and engaging grin.
Thanks, anyway.
Now let's hear about this island, I suggested, and he glanced about the cabin.
Let's go up on the bridge, he suggested.
And out in the open air, he took a stub of pencil and a scrap pad from the map bin above the chart table.
I reckon it lies off the African shore about 6 to 10 miles, and 10 to 30 miles north of the mouth of the Rovuma River.
Well, that covers a hell of a lot of ground, Jim, as you've noticed during the last few days. What else do you know about it?
He hesitated a little longer before grudgingly doling out a few more coins from his hoard. He took the pencil and drew a horizontal line across the pad.
Sea level, he said.
And then, above the line, he raised an irregular profile that started low and then climbed steeply into 3 distinct peaks before ending abruptly.
And that's the silhouette that it shows from the sea. The 3 hills are volcanic basalt, sheer rock with little vegetation.
Oh, the old men. I recognized it immediately.
But you're a long way out in your other calculations. It's more like 20 miles offshore.
But within sight of the mainland? He asked quickly.
It has to be within sight.
Oh, sure, you could see a long way from the tops of the hills.
I pointed out as he tore the sheet from the pad and carefully ripped it to shreds and dropped them into the harbour.
How far north of the river?
He turned back to face me.
Offhand, I'd say 60 or 70 miles.
And he looked thoughtful.
Yes. Yes, it could be that far north. It could fit. It depends on how long it would take.
He didn't finish. He was taking my advice about playing it cool.
Can you take us there, Skip?
I nodded. But it's a long run, and best come prepared to sleep on the boat overnight.
I'll fetch the others, he said, eager and excited once more.
But on the wharf he looked back at the bridge.
About the island, you know, what it looks like and all that.
Don't discuss it with the others.
Okay?
Okay, Jim, I smiled back at him. Off you go.
I went down to have a look at the Admiralty chart. The old men were the highest point on a ridge of basalt, a long, hard reef that ran parallel to the mainland for 200 miles. It disappeared below the water, but reappeared at intervals, forming a regular feature amongst the haphazard sprinkling of coral and sand islands and shoals. It was marked as uninhabited and waterless, and the sounding showed a number of deep channels through the reefs around it. Although it was far north of my regular grounds, yet I had visited the area the previous year as host to a marine biology expedition from the University College of Los Angeles, who were studying the breeding habits of the green turtles that abounded there. We'd camped for 3 days on another island across the tide channel from the old men, where there was an all-weather anchorage in an enclosed lagoon and brackish but just drinkable water in a fisherman's well amongst the palms. Looking across from the anchorage, the old men showed exactly the outline that Jimmy had sketched for me. That was how I'd recognized it so readily. Half an hour later, the whole party arrived. Strapped on the roof of the taxi was a bulky piece of equipment covered with a green canvas dust sheet. They hired a couple of lounging islanders to carry this, and the overnight bags they had with them, down to the wharf where I was waiting. They stowed the canvas package on the foredeck without unwrapping it, and I asked no questions.
Guthrie's face was starting to fall off in layers of sun-scorched skin, leaving wet, red flesh exposed. He had smeared white cream over it. I thought of him slapping little Marion around his suite at the Hilton, and I smiled at him.
"You look so good. Ever thought of running for Miss Universe?"
And he glowered at me from beneath the brim of his hat as he took his seat in the fighting chair. During the run northwards, he drank beer straight from the can and used the empties as targets, firing the big pistol at them as they tumbled and bobbed in Dancer's wake. A little before noon, I gave Jimmy the wheel and went down to use the heads below deck. I found that Matteson had the bar open and the gin bottle out.
"How much longer?"
he asked, sweaty and flushed, despite the air conditioning. "Oh, another hour or so," I told him, and thought that Matteson was going to find himself with a drinking problem, the way he handled spirits at midday. However, the gin had mellowed him a little, and always the opportunist, I loosened another £300 from his wallet as an advance against my fees before going up to take Dancer in on the last leg through the northern channel that led to the old men. The Triple Peaks came up through the heat haze, ghostly grey and ominous, seeming to hang disembodied above the channel. Jimmy was examining the peaks through his binoculars, and then he lowered them and turned delightedly to me.
"That looks like it, Skipper."
And he clambered down into the cockpit. The three of them went up onto the foredeck, past the canvas-wrapped deck cargo, and stood shoulder to shoulder at the rail, staring through the sea fret at the island as I crept cautiously up the channel. We had a rising tide pushing us up the channel, and I agreed to use it to approach the eastern tip of the old men and make a landing on the beach below the nearest peak. This coast has a tidal fall of 17 feet at full springs, and it is unwise to go into shallow water on the ebb. It is easy to find yourself stranded high and dry as the water falls away beneath your keel. Jimmy borrowed my hand-bearing compass and packed it with his chart, a thermos of iced water, and a bottle of salt tablets from the medicine chest into his haversack. While I crept cautiously in towards the beach, Jimmy and Matteson stripped off their footwear and trousers. When Dancer bumped her keel softly on the hard white sand of the beach, I shouted to them, "Okay, over you go." And with Jimmy leading, they went down the ladder I'd rigged from Dancer's side. The water came up to their armpits, and James held the haversack above his head as they waded towards the beach.
"2 hours," I called after them. "If you're longer than that, you can sleep ashore. I'm not coming in to pick you up on the ebb."
Jimmy waved and grinned. I put Dancer into reverse and backed off cautiously. While the two of them reached the beach and hopped around awkwardly as they donned their trousers and shoes, and then set off into the palm groves and disappeared from view. After circling for 10 minutes and peering down through the water that was clear as a trout stream, I picked up the dark shadow across the bottom that I was seeking and dropped a light head anchor. While Guthrie watched with interest, I put on a faceplate and gloves and went over the side with a small oyster net and a heavy tire lever. There was 40 feet of water under us, and I was pleased to find my wind was still sufficient to allow me to go down and prise loose a netful of the big double-shelled sun clams in one dive. I shucked them onto the foredeck, and then, mindful of Chubby's admonitions, I threw the empty shells overboard and swabbed the deck carefully before taking a pailful of the sweet flesh down to the galley. They went into a casserole pot with wine and garlic, salt and ground pepper, and just a bite of chili. I set the gas plate to simmer and put the lid on the pot. When I went back on deck, Guthrie was still in the fighting chair.
"What's wrong, Big Shot?
Are you bored?" I asked solicitously.
"No little girls to kick around?"
His eyes narrowed thoughtfully. I could see him checking out my source of information.
"You've got a big mouth, Bruce. Somebody's going to close it for you one day."
We exchanged a few more pleasantries, none of them much above this level, but it served to pass the time until the two distant figures appeared on the beach and waved and hallooed. I pulled up the hook and went in to pick them up. Immediately they were aboard, they called Guthrie to them and assembled on the foredeck for one of their group sessions. They were all excited, Jimmy the most so, and he gesticulated and pointed out into the channel, talking quietly but vehemently. For once they seemed all to be in agreement. But by the time they'd finished talking, there was half an hour of sunlight left, and I refused to agree to Mattison's demands that I should continue our explorations that evening. I had no wish to creep around in the darkness on an ebb tide. Firmly, I took a dancer across to the safe anchorage in the lagoon across the channel. And by the time the sun went down below a blazing horizon, I had Dancer riding peacefully on two heavy anchors, and I was sitting on the bridge enjoying the last of the day and the first scotch of the evening. In the saloon below me there was the interminable murmur of discussion and speculation. I ignored it, not even bothering to use the ventilator, until the first mosquitoes found their way across the lagoon and began whining around my ears. I went below, and the conversation dried up at my entry. I thickened the juice and served my clam casserole with baked yams and pineapple salad, and they ate in dedicated silence. "My God, that's even better than my sister's cooking," Jimmy gasped finally. I grinned at him. I am rather vain about my culinary skills, and young James was clearly a gourmet. I woke after midnight and went up on deck to check Dancer's moorings. She was all secure, and I paused to enjoy the moonlight. A great stillness lay upon the night, disturbed only by the soft chuckle of the tide against Dancer's side, and far off the boom of the surf on the outer reef. It was coming in big and tall from the open ocean, and breaking in thunder and white upon the coral of Gunfire Reef. The name was well chosen, and the deep, belly-shaking thump of it sounded exactly like the regular salute of a minute gun. The moonlight washed the channel with shimmering silver and highlighted the bald domes of the peaks of the old men so that they shone like ivory. Below them, the night mists rising from the lagoon writhed and twisted like tormented souls. Suddenly I caught the whisper of movement behind me, and I whirled to face it. Guthrie had followed me as silently as a hunting leopard. He wore only a pair of jockey shorts, and his body was white and muscled and lean in the moonlight. He carried the big black .45, dangling at arm's length by his right thigh. We stared at each other for a moment before I relaxed. "You know, love, you've just got to give up now. You really aren't my type at all," I told him. But there was adrenaline in my blood, and my voice rasped. "When the time comes to rim you, Fletcher, I'll be using this," he said, and lifted the automatic. "All the way up, boy." And he grinned. We ate breakfast before sunup, and I took my mug of coffee to the bridge to drink as we ran up the channel towards the open sea. Mattison was below, and Guthrie lolled in the fighting chair. Jimmy stood beside me and explained his requirements for this day. He was tense with excitement, seeming to quiver with it like a young gun dog with the first scent of the bird in his nostrils. "I want to get some shots off the peaks of the old men," he explained. "I want to use your hand-bearing compass, and I'll call you in." "Give me your bearings, Jim, and I'll plot it and put you on the spot," I suggested. "Let's do it my way, Skipper," he replied awkwardly, and I could not prevent a flare of irritation in my reply. "Oh, all right then, Eagle Scout." He flushed and went to the port rail to sight the peaks through the lens of the compass. It was 10 minutes or so before he spoke again. "Can we turn about 2 points to port now, Skipper?" "Sure we can," I grinned at him, "but of course that would pile us on to the end of Gunfire Reef, and we'd tear our belly out." It took another 2 hours of groping about through the maze of reefs before I'd worked Dancer out through the channel into the open sea and circled back to approach Gunfire Reef from the east. It was like the child's game of Hunt the Thimble. Jimmy called hotter and colder without supplying me with the two references that would enable me to place Dancer on the precise spot he was seeking. Out here, the swells marched in majestic procession towards the land, growing taller and more powerful as they felt the shelving bottom. Dancer rolled and swung to them as we edged in towards the outer reef. Where the swells met the barrier of coral, their dignity turned to sudden fury, and they boiled up and burst in leviathan spouts of spray, pouring wildly over the coral with the explosive shock of impact. Then they sucked back, exposing the black, evil fangs, white water cascading and creaming from the barrier, while the next swell moved up, humping its great slick back for the next assault. Jimmy was directing me steadily southwards, in a gradual converging course with the reef, and I could tell we were very close to his marks. Through the compass he squinted eagerly, first at one and then the other peak of the old men. "Steady as you go, skipper," he called. "Just ease her down on that heading." I looked ahead, tearing my eyes away from the menacing coral for a few seconds, and I watched the next swell charge in and break, except at a narrow point, 500 yards ahead. Here the swell kept its shape and ran on uninterrupted towards the land. On each side the swell broke on coral, but just at that one point it was open. Suddenly I remembered Chubby's boast. "I was just 19 when I pulled my first jewfish out of the whole Gumpa break. Wasn't no other would fish with me. Don't say as I blame him. Wouldn't go into the break again. Got a little more brains now." Gunfire break. Suddenly, I knew that was where we were heading. I tried to remember exactly what Chubby had told me about it. "If you come in from the sea, about 2 hours before high water, steer for the centre of the gap until you come up level with the big old head of brain coral on your starboard side. You'll know it when you see it. Pass it close as you can, and then come round hard to starboard, and you'll be sitting a big hole, tucked in neatly behind the main reef. Closer you are on the back of the reef, the better man." I remembered it clearly then. Chubby, in his talkative phase in the public bar of the Lord Nelson, boastful as one of the very few men who'd been through the gunfire break. "No anchor gonna hold you there. You gotta lean on the oars to hold station in the gap. The hole at Gunfire Break is deep, man, deep. But the dewfish in there are big, man, big. One day I took 4 fish, and the smallest were 300 pounds. Could have took more, but time was up. You can't stay in Gunfire Break more than an hour after high water. She sucks out through the break like they pulled the chain on the whole damn sea. You come out the same way you went in, only you pray just a little harder on the way out, 'cause you got a ton of fish on board, and 10 feet less water under your keel. There is another way out through a channel in back of the reef, but I don't even like to talk about that one. Only tried it once." And now we were bearing down directly on the break. Jimmy was going to run us right into the eye of it. "Okay, Jim," I called. "That's as far as we go." I opened the throttle and sheered off, making a good offing before turning back to face Jimmy's wrath. "We were almost there, damn you," he blustered. "We could have gone a little closer."
"You having trouble up there, boy?"
Guthrie shouted up from the cockpit.
"No, it's all right,"
Jimmy called back, and then turned furiously to me.
"You are under contract, Mr. Fletcher."
"I want to show you something, James." And I took him to the chart table.
The break was marked on the Admiralty chart by a single laconic sounding of 30 fathoms. There was no name or sailing instruction for it. Quickly I penciled in the bearings of the 2 extreme peaks of the old men from the break, and then used the protractor to measure the angle they subtended.
"That right?" I asked him.
And he stared at my figures.
"It's right, isn't it?"
I insisted. And then reluctantly he nodded. "Yes. Yes, that's the spot," he agreed. And I went on to tell him about Gunfire Break in every detail.
"But we have to get in there," he said at the end of my speech, as though he hadn't heard a word of it.
"No way," I told him. "The only place I'm interested in now is Grand Harbour, St. Mary's Island. And I laid Dancer on that course. As far as I was concerned, the charter was over."
Jimmy disappeared down the ladder and returned with reinforcements,
Matteson and Guthrie, both of them looking angry and outraged.
"Say the word and I'll tear the bastard's arm off and beat him to death with a wet end," Mike Guthrie said with relish.
"The kid says you pulling out," Matteson wanted to know. "That's not right, is it?"
I explained once more about the hazards of gunfire break, and they sobered immediately.
"Well, take me as close as you can. I'll swim in the rest of the way," Jimmy asked me.
But I replied directly to Matteson.
"You'd lose him for certain, sure. Do you want to risk that?"
He didn't answer, but I could see that Jimmy was much too valuable for them to take the chance.
"Let me try," Jimmy insisted. But Matteson shook his head irritably. "But if we can't get into the break, at least let me take a run along the reef with the sledge," Jimmy went on. And then I knew what we were carrying under the canvas wrapping on the foredeck.
Just a couple of passes along the front edge of the reef, past the entrance to the break."
He was pleading now, and Matteson looked questioningly at me.
"You don't often have opportunities like this offered you on a silver tray." I knew I could run Dancer within spitting distance of the coddle without risk. But I frowned worriedly.
"Well, I'd be taking a hell of a chance. But if we could agree on a bit of old danger money..."
I had Matteson over the arm of the chair, and I caned him for an extra day's hire, $500 payable in advance. While we did the business, Guthrie helped Jimmy unwrap the sledge and carry it back to the cockpit. I tucked the sheath of banknotes away and went back to rig the tow lines. The sledge was a beautifully constructed toboggan of stainless steel and plastic. In place of snow runners, it had stubby fin controls, rudder, and hydrofoils, operated by a short joystick below the Perspex pilot's shield. There was a ring bolt in the nose to take the tow line by which I would drag the sledge in Dancer's wake. Jimmy would lie on his belly behind the transparent shield, breathing compressed air from the twin tanks that were built into the chassis of the sled. On the dashboard were depth and pressure gauges, directional compass, and time elapsed clock. With the joystick, Jimmy could control the depth of the sledge's dive and yaw left or right across Dancer's stern.
"That's a lovely piece of work," I remarked,
and he flushed with pleasure.
"Thanks, Skipper. Built it myself."
He was pulling on the wet suit of thick, black, neoprene rubber, and while his head was in the clinging hood, I stooped and examined the maker's plate that was riveted to the sledge's chassis, memorizing the legend, "Built by North Underwater World, 5 Pavilion Arcade, Brighton, Sussex." I straightened up as his face appeared in the opening of the hood.
5 knots is a good tow speed, Skipper. If you keep 100 yards off the reef, I'll be able to deflect outwards and follow the contour of the coddle.
Oh, fine, Jim.
If I put up a yellow marker, ignore it. It's only a find, and we'll go back to it later. But if I send up a red, it's trouble. Try and get me off the reef and haul me in.
I nodded. Well, you've got 3 hours, I warned him. Then she'll begin the ebb up through the break, and we'll have to haul off.
Oh, that should be long enough, he agreed.
Guthrie and I lifted the sledge over the side, and it wallowed low in the water. Jimmy clambered down to it and settled himself behind the screen, testing the controls, adjusting his faceplate, and cramming the mouthpiece of the breathing device into his mouth. He breathed noisily, and then gave me the thumbs up. I climbed quickly to the bridge and opened the throttles. Dancer picked up speed, and Guthrie paid out the thick nylon rope over the stern as the sledge fell away behind us. 150 yards of rope went over before the sledge jerked and began to tow. Jimmy waved, and I pushed Dancer up to a steady 5 knots. I circled wide, then edged in towards the reef, taking the big swells on Dancer's beam, so she rolled appallingly. Again Jimmy waved, and I saw him push the control column of the sledge forwards. There was a turmoil of white water along her control fins, and then suddenly she put her nose down and ducked below the surface. The angle of the nylon rope altered rapidly as the sledge went down and then swung away towards the reef. The strain on the rope made it quiver like an arrow as it strikes, and the water squirted from the fibres.
Slowly we ran parallel to the reef, closing the break. I watched the coral respectfully, taking no chances, and I imagined Jimmy far below the surface, flying silently along the bottom, cutting in to skim the tall wall of underwater coral. It must have been an exhilarating sensation, and I envied him, deciding to hitch a ride on the sledge when I got the opportunity. We came opposite the bank, the break, past it, and just then I heard Guthrie shout. I glanced quickly over the stern and saw the big yellow balloon bobbing in our wake.
"He found something,"
Guthrie shouted. Jimmy had dropped a light-leaded line, and a sparklet bulb had automatically inflated the yellow balloon with carbon dioxide gas to mark the spot. I kept going steadily along the reef, and a quarter of a mile further, the angle of the tow line flattened and the sledge popped up to the surface in a welter of water. I swung away from the reef to a safe distance and then went down to help Guthrie recover the sledge. Jimmy clambered into the cockpit, and when he pulled off his faceplate, his lips were trembling and his grey eyes blazed. He took Mattison's arm and dragged him into the cabin, splashing seawater all over Chubby's beloved deck. Guthrie and I coiled the rope, then lifted the sledge into the cockpit. I went back to the bridge and took Dancer on a slow return to the entrance of Gunfire Break. Mattison and Jimmy came up on the bridge before we reached it. Mattison was affected by Jimmy's excitement.
"The kid wants to try for a pickup."
I knew better than to ask what it was. "What size?" I asked instead, and glanced at my wristwatch. We had an hour and a half before the riptide began to run out through the break. "Not very big," Jimmy assured me. "£50 maximum."
"You sure, James?"
"Not bigger." I didn't trust his enthusiasm not to minimize the effort involved. "I swear it."
"You want to put an airbag on it?"
"Yes, I'll lift it with an airbag and then tow it away from the reef." I reversed Dancer in gingerly towards the yellow balloon that played lightly in the angry coral jaws of the break.
"That's as close as I'll go,"
I shouted down into the cockpit, and Jimmy acknowledged with a wave. He waddled duck-footed to the stern and adjusted his equipment. He had taken two airbags as well as the canvas cover from the sledge and was roped up to the coil of nylon rope. I saw him take a bearing on the yellow marker with a compass on his wrist, and then once again he glanced up at me on the bridge before he flipped backwards over the stern and disappeared. His regular breathing burst in a white rash below the stern and then began to move off towards the reef. Guthrie paid out the body line after him. I kept Dancer on station by using bursts of forward and reverse, holding her 100 yards from the southern tip of the break. Slowly, Jimmy's bubbles approached the yellow marker and then broke steadily beside it. He was working below it, and I imagined him fixing the airbags to the object with the nylon slings. It would be hard work with the suck and drag of the current worrying the bulky bags. Once he'd fitted the slings, he could begin to fill the bags with compressed air from his scuba bottles. If Jimmy's estimate of size was correct, it would need very little inflation to pull the mysterious object off the bottom, and once it dangled free, we could tow it into a safer area before bringing it aboard. For 40 minutes I held Dancer steady, and then quite suddenly two swollen, green, shiny mounds broke the surface astern. The airbags were up. Jimmy had lifted his prize. Immediately, his hooded head surfaced beside the filled bags, and he held his right arm straight up, the signal to begin the tow.
"Ready?"
I shouted at Guthrie in the cockpit.
"Ready?"
He'd secured the line, and I crept away from the reef slowly and carefully to avoid upending the bags and spilling out the air that gave them lift. 500 yards off the reef, I kicked Dancer into neutral and went to help haul in the swimmer and his fat green airbags.
"Stay where you are,"
Mattison snarled at me as I approached the ladder. And I shrugged and went back to the wheel. Ah, the hell with them all, I thought, and lit a cheroot. But I couldn't prevent the tickle of excitement as they worked the bags alongside and then walked them forward to the bows. They helped Jimmy aboard, and he shrugged off the heavy compressed air bottles, dropping them to the deck while he pushed his faceplate onto his forehead.
His voice, ragged and high-pitched, carried clearly to me as I leaned on the bridge rail.
"Jackpot!" he cried. "It's the..."
"Watch it," Matteson cautioned him, and James cut himself off when they looked at me, lifting their faces to the bridge. "Don't mind me, boys," I grinned and waved the cheroot cheerily. They turned away and huddled. Jimmy whispered, and Guthrie said, "Jesus Christ!" loudly, and slapped Matteson's back. And then they were all exclaiming and laughing as they crowded to the rail and began to lift the airbags and their burden aboard. They were clumsy with it. Dancer was rolling heavily, and I leaned forward with curiosity eating a hole in my belly. My disappointment and chagrin were intense when I realized that Jimmy had taken the precaution of wrapping his prize in the canvas sledge cover. It came aboard as a sodden, untidy bundle of canvas, swathed in coils of nylon rope. It was heavy. I could see by the manner in which they handled it. But it was not bulky, the size of a small suitcase. They laid it on the deck and stood around it happily. Matteson smiled up at me.
"Okay, Fletcher. Come, take a look."
It was beautifully done. He played like a concert pianist on my curiosity. Suddenly I wanted very badly to know what they had pulled up from the sea. I clamped the cheroot in my teeth as I swarmed down the ladder and hurried towards the group in the bows. I was halfway across the foredeck, right out in the open, and Matteson was still smiling as he said softly, "Now." Only then did I know it was a setup, and my mind began to move so fast that it all seemed to go by in extreme slow motion. I saw the evil black bulk of the 45 in Guthrie's fist, and it came up slowly to aim into my belly. Mike Guthrie was in the marksman's crouch, right arm fully extended, and he was grinning as he screwed up those speckled eyes and sighted along the thick-jacketed barrel. I saw Jimmy North's handsome young face contort with horror, saw him reach out to grip the pistol arm, but Matteson, still grinning, shoved him roughly aside, and he staggered away with Dancer's next roll. I was thinking quite clearly and rapidly. It was not a procession of thought, but a set of simultaneous images. I thought how neatly they dropped the boom on me. A really professional hit. I thought how presumptuous I'd been in trying to make a deal with the Wolfpack. For them it was easier to hit than to negotiate. I thought that they would take out Jimmy now that he'd watched this. That must have been in their intention from the start. I was sorry for that. I'd come to like the kid. I thought about the heavy, soft, explosive lead slug that the 4-5 threw. About how it would tear up the target, hitting with the shock of 2,000 foot-pounds. Guthrie's forefinger curled on the trigger, and I began to throw myself at the rail beside me with the cheroot still in my mouth. But I knew it was too late. The pistol in Guthrie's hand kicked up, head high, and I saw the muzzle flash palely in the sunlight. The cannon roar of the blast and the heavy lead bullet hit me together. The din deafened me and snapped my head back, and the cheroot flipped up high in the air, leaving a trail of sparks. Then the impact of the bullet doubled me over, driving the air from my lungs, and lifted me off my feet, hurling me backwards until the deck rail caught me in the small of the back. There was no pain, just that huge, numbing shock. It was in the chest, I was sure of that, and I knew that it must have blown me open. It was a mortal wound, I was sure of that also, and I expected my mind to go now. I expected to fade, going out into blackness. Instead, the rail caught me in the back, and I somersaulted, going over the side head first, and the quick, cold embrace of the sea covered me. It steadied me, and I opened my eyes to the silver clouds of bubbles and the soft green of sunlight through the surface. My lungs were empty, the air driven out by the impact of the bullet, and my instinct told me to claw to the surface for air. But surprisingly, my mind was still clear, and I knew that Mike Guthrie would blow the top off my skull the moment I surfaced. I rolled and dived, kicking clumsily, and went down under Dancer's hull.